From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A young protester with Black Lives Matter was killed and another critically injured in Seattle, Washington, after a car hit both at a high speed during a protest on an interstate highway. The protester, a young person who identified as non-binary, named Summer Taylor, was live streaming the event for 2 hours on social media when they were hit and died. The suspect, an African-American man named Dawit Ketele, fled the scene but was arrested and no motive is yet known. Seattle has been a center of anti-police brutality protests since the May 25th police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Just days before the fatal protest incident, police dismantled a multi-block zone around an abandoned precinct that activists had dubbed the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. That area later came to be known as the Capitol Hill Organized Protest. My guest is Arun Gupta. He's an investigative journalist who's written for The Washington Post, The Nation, Raw Story, The Guardian, and Jacobin. He's also a regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. And his latest article, just published by The Intercept, is entitled Seattle's Chop Went Out with Both a Bang and a Whimper. Welcome to the program, Arun.
Good to be with you, Sonali.
So we spoke very soon after the George Floyd protests had begun. And of course, this is a nationwide movement. Some have even analyzed it as potentially the largest movement the U.S. has ever had. But Seattle has been an epicenter. Why? There is a history in Seattle around police brutality that predates what we've seen in just the last few months, right?
Yeah, you know, like any other city, unfortunately, in the United States, there's been the killing of African Americans, basically, you know, what looks to be outright murder over the years. And, you know, the police force is very much accountable, unaccountable. It's also rather violent. You know, Seattle, its nickname is the Emerald City because it is so stunningly beautiful with its mountain and waterways and pine trees, you know, and forests. But the police there are very aggressive. They use their weapons of war on the public quite frequently. And what created the conditions for the CHOP, as it became to be known, had to do all with police violence in the city.
So before we get to what actually took place inside the area, let's talk about what's been in the news, which is over the weekend, you know, one of the protests that had been going on, not in the CHOP, because by then it was dismantled, but on a freeway. It had been happening for several hours. And I watched a video of it. It looked like it was almost sort of over or almost over at the time. And you had a white car that came careening down the freeway. And before activists had the chance to respond, it violently hit two of the protesters, one of whom, named Summer Taylor, died. This is a big shock to the Seattle activist community, someone who is a dedicated protester. What do you think happened?
Well, we don't have the full story. We only, and this is coming from the police, so obviously a lot of what they say is suspect. In terms of the driver himself, what the police are saying is that he went the wrong way up an exit ramp. And then you can see the video is horrific, but you can see the car coming down an empty freeway. There's vehicles that are blocking the path. He goes around the vehicles and the protesters scatter, but he drives straight into the two protesters, killing Summer Taylor. Now, the thing is, you know, when I saw this, I started looking into it. And one, this has been going on night after night after night. This is a 19th straight day in a row that protesters have taken the I-5 freeway. Secondly, I've living in New York, I used to participate in these massive critical mass bike rides where you would have thousands of bicyclists. Angeles, and we would take freeways and tunnels and bridges. And the police, as you can imagine, obviously didn't like it, but they kind of let it go on for a few years before they pounced and started arresting hundreds of people right as the 2004 Republican National Convention began. But up until then, they would just block all the entrances and exits. They would tail us with squad cars and motorcycle cops. And so the thing is, it's not that hard. The police knew this was going to happen. The police took responsibility for blocking off the freeways. And the third point, I think what's most appalling is there have been numerous car attacks on protesters in Seattle prior to this. There was, in fact, a car attack about an hour and a half earlier that same night by a Seattle police officer in her private vehicle. There had been previously, the day before the chop began, this man drove into a crowd of protesters in Capitol Hill. No one was hit, but he drives wildly into the crowd. A man in the crowd grabs a steering wheel to stop him. The suspect pulls out a gun, shoots the man in the arm, and then exits waving this Glock with an extended magazine, and then is allowed to calmly surrender to the police in the Capitol Hill. So the police know that protesters are targets. And there have been over 50 of these documented car attacks across the country, often by police themselves. You know, in Detroit, Los Angeles, and New York, there's video of police ramming protesters, on-duty police. So I think this is a complete failure by the city, by Mayor Jenny Durkan, by the state police for allowing this to happen. It's not hard to block a freeway. There's limited entrance and exit ramps. So, you know, unfortunately, it's just tragic what happened to Summer Taylor. But if there's going to be any justice for them, I think it's going to have to be, you know, coming out in some sort of inquiry, some sort of lawsuit to determine why this was allowed to happen.
And it's not clear yet if the driver of the car had a motive or not. Of course, it's complicated. He was not a police officer. There's no indication he was a right-wing conservative. He was African American, and watching the video, it seems, and you know, I really want to warn our viewers, if you do find it on the internet, be warned, it is very difficult to watch. As journalists, you and I, Arun, have to watch these things. And from my viewing of it, it didn't necessarily seem like he was targeting those two people in particular. He just, the car was going at such a high speed, he hit whoever happened to be there at the time, and he might have hit more people, but others scattered. So we'll certainly see where this story heads. And it's interesting because, of course, while those who are mourning Summer Taylor's death are calling for the police to crack down, you end up feeding that very machine that you are calling on to be dismantled.
Yes, that's very much true. And that's exactly what we saw going on in the CHOP, the Capitol Hill organized protests, when we were there. And that lasted for about 3 weeks. And the issue of safety. So, I mean, you know, the police claim that their role is to provide public safety. And what we've seen with this movement, you know, what a lot of people are calling the George Floyd movement, is this questioning, first of all, what is public safety? You know, 90% of what police do shouldn't be in their purview, such as responding to the homeless, responding to those who have mental health issues. But when you do have incidents like this, or what happened with the CHOP, where there were numerous shootings, starting the night of Juneteenth, there were at least four different shootings, and two people were killed around the chop, you know, what is the role of some sort of body to provide public safety? But the thing is, what we see is that the police are not doing this. You know, in the case of what happened on the freeway, the state police said, you know, we can't guarantee your safety, and we're going to arrest anyone who tries to go on the freeway again. And I believe actually people did go on the freeway again the next night. But you know, that's kind of a pretty bizarre thing to say, that we can't guarantee your safety when freeways are very easy to block off. But you know, the thing about the chop, it's one of the issues that really started, I think, to cause it to fall apart, was the issue of, you know, providing safety there. And you did have people who were walking around with guns. There were groups that were providing security. There was a one white-led group that called themselves the Sentinels, and I believe or were affiliated with the John Brown Gun Club. But they left because other people who were in the chop felt, you know, there shouldn't be a group of whites who were providing security. But a couple of nights before, the police moved in and forced out the remaining protesters in the chop. There was an incident where two kids, really, a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old, and the details of it are pretty fuzzy. They apparently stole a vehicle. Their allegations, and there's some video evidence of this, may have been driving around the perimeter, shooting into the chop. And one security person I talked to claimed it was a gang initiation that kind of went awry. They eventually crash into a concrete barrier, and there's all this firing. And the security person told me at least three people in the chop essentially unloaded their guns into the car, and they killed the 16-year-old who was driving and critically wounded the 14-year-old.
Right, so two
But
people have been killed and several injured over the course of the Capitol Hill organized protest zone.
yeah, and what people kept saying, what I heard from everyone, and again, it's not confirmed, and it's important that, you know, we understand it may be true, but we don't know if it's true. That they were saying that the police had essentially pulled back from blocks around the chop, and I think there is some credence to it, because the shootings that get pinned on the chop, none of them happen inside the occupied protest zone itself. They happen on the perimeter or even a couple of blocks away. And all the indications are that this may have been gang-related activity. You know, when the chop first happened, like other occupations that we've seen happen over the last decade, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy ICE, even to a degree Occupy Sandy, it becomes this festival like atmosphere. And so it started to attract a lot of people, houseless people. And it's understandable, you know, as one person explained, like, look, there's free stuff. There was this no cop co-op that was giving out just all these free things, you know, like toiletry and food. There's these free kitchens. There's people who are helping with housing, with tech support, medical care. It's a safe place to stay. And there's also hope, as the one person described. So they said, of course, you know, it's going to attract a lot of homeless people. And there was a large homeless encampment in the park that was a part of the CHOP, the Cal Anderson Park. And I talked to some people in there, and one woman claimed that, you know, there were just all these people around looking for drugs, you know, living a homeless person who was living part of the encampment there. There were at least 100 people living in the park. And security people said, you know, well, you know, it's just like people are going to do drugs. And when people do drugs, there's a market. And when there's a market, you know, people are going to try and control the market. And so this may have been the origins of the gang activity, but certainly the police were doing nothing for blocks around. And their allegations from business people, supposedly, that the police were not responding to their calls even outside the shop. So I can believe there's malign neglect on part of the police.
Right. You covered Occupy Wall Street in depth when that movement that took place, of course, during the Obama administration was in its heyday. And we've seen, and you refer to some of the other occupations as they're being, as they have been called since then. What are some of the lessons that you see activists, you know, might be noticing that emerge from these sorts of encampments, these organized protests, if you will? Because although there is the downside that you've just been discussing, the upside is that we see these pretty incredible sorts of mini societies that very quickly get established. And to me, I see that as a lesson in how communities can be self-reliant, can actually look out for one another. And it seems as though Americans who might be yearning for a sense of community find that they can create it when they are in such spaces.
I think that's true. There's very much a tension, you know, with Occupy ICE, which I was also at, and Occupy Sandy as well. The problem is the camp can overwhelm what the protest is about. Now, currently also in New York City, there's an Occupy City Hall. And I think one of the lessons, so it's no longer, both with the CHOP and Occupy City Hall in New York, where they're camping out across from City Hall, demanding a $1 billion cut to the $6 billion police budget. It's not this kind of open horizontal organizing that you saw during Occupy. And I think that is inherently problematic. It's always going to collapse under its own weight, because when anyone can come into the group and basically have a voice, you know, it's basically what happens is you get decision-making power without any responsibility. And it kind of leads the neediest people to become dominant.
It sounds so much like Pacifica radio stations, local station boards.
Yeah. Very, very much so. I think this fetishization of, you know, horizontalism has been disastrous, frankly. And so with the CHOP and Occupy City, now with the CHOP, it was African-Americans, it was Black-led. With Occupy City Hall, it was apparently started by a dozen or so African-Americans who work in nonprofit groups. So that has its own contradictions, but what happens there is it is much more focused. It's not having, you don't have to worry about, you know, people who are coming in. And this isn't even about infiltrators. I think people on the left have too much of a problem of seeing like a cop under every bed. There are plenty of people who are needy and have socialization problems, who if you allow them to have the floor are just going to be disruptive whether they want to or not. The problem, though, with the CHOP was, you know, we kept hearing the term, you know, follow Black leadership, but no one could define what that meant. And as one can suspect, that provides very thin covering to unify what is obviously a huge and complex community with lots of sections, interests, agendas, types of politics. So there were tensions between new activists and old activists, tensions between those who were kind of more militant street activists versus those who were coming in from nonprofits. One gentleman who I talked to and I interviewed for the article, He said, you know, don't come in here with your damn nonprofit. This isn't about getting grants. You know, we're not out here protesting so your nonprofit can get grants. We're out here protesting to stop the police killing of Black people. And apparently there were African-American groups and individuals coming out there looking to get money. And he also said, you know, that, you know, this is what white people do. They throw money at problems. He said he would get on the microphone and talk, and white people would come up to him and be like, that was so powerful. Do you have a cause I can give money to? And he was like, I don't want your damn money. You know, this isn't about money. And he also said, you know, that there were activists there who everyone's trying to get into the meeting with to be a leader because they want to get into the meeting with the mayor to fund my organization.
Right.
So there is a lot of opportunism.
There, against all of this, the backdrop of all of this has been that Seattle, as a city that is led on a lot of liberal issues, also is experiencing a lot of tensions within its city council. And there is a movement to, and has been a movement to tax Amazon, the world's largest retailer, which is headquartered in Seattle. And City Council member Kshama Sawant, who is a frequent guest on our program, has led that charge. And only recently is the City Council now coming to agreement over taxing Amazon. So she actually represents the district that the Capitol Hill neighborhood is located in. So how do you view the anti-police brutality protests within this broader movement in Seattle around economic justice?
Well, police brutality is very much an economic issue because of the fact that, you know, something like one third of Black men without a college education are cycled through the criminal justice system, you know, and once you are imprisoned, basically everything in your life statistically goes south, right? You know, your earnings go down, you're less likely to be employed, your educational opportunities, your housing opportunities, your life expectancy is all negatively impacted. You know, and Seattle has just extreme racial income inequality. So nationwide, African Americans make about 65 cents on the dollar for every dollar that a white person makes. In Seattle, it's 40 cents. On the dollar. So it's absolutely appalling, extreme racial inequality. And the CHOP is, you know, it's kind of the Stonewall, the West Village of New York City. It's a neighborhood where queer and trans activism really developed. But there is another neighborhood known as the Central District that at one point, I believe, you know, in the 50s or 60s was over 50% African American. It's now down to something like 20% or less African American because you have this massive gentrification led by particularly Amazon and Microsoft. These are two of the three largest public corporations in the world. Each one of them is worth about $1.4 trillion. And Amazon in particular fought tooth and nail against Kshama Sawant's attempt to impose a wealth tax on it.
They funded a candidate against her in the last election.
Exactly. And she had, in fact, like I think 2 years ago, had essentially gotten a tax on Amazon, a head tax. Approved, and then Amazon basically stopped work on some construction projects and threatened to pull out, which is completely absurd. It's not going to pull out over a couple $100 million, but it worked, and the city council then killed its own tax proposal. They overturned it a couple weeks later, and so then they spent a huge sum of money trying to defeat her. And she's basically been opposed by the complete like bourgeois establishment. You know, the corporate media is like totally antagonistic towards her. When she ran for re-election, which I covered, I believe it was 2015, basically nearly every incumbent on the city council endorsed her opponent which is virtually unheard of for incumbents to oppose another incumbent. But she has come back and she's been able to get this tax in place. And so, you know, people are like, you know, we need funding for African American communities. And that is very much true, that until we as a society and in terms of the governmental units address the economic inequality, the racism, the wealth disparity, the underfunding of African Americans, we're not going to be able to overcome the structural racism in the society.
So, Arun, with what is happening around police brutality in the nation, of course, we see our president at the same time whipping up this, you know, what many are calling a culture war. Just over the weekend, he gave two speeches, one on Friday and one on Saturday, around sort of 4th of July, his own political campaign for re-election. It's a pretty remarkable moment where he is essentially telling his supporters that they get free rein in attacking what he's calling the radical left. He's referred to leftist mobs. He's even started using the term fascists to describe left-wing activists. He has essentially equated Black Lives Matter, which now even mainstream corporate America embraces. He's established it as akin to a terrorist organization. Are you worried that this moment, which is, you know, predates Trump, the fight for justice against police brutality, that the timing of this with Trump's presidency is actually, you know, going to make things a lot worse, that police will see and right-wing protesters will see Trump on their side?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's clearly on their side. You know, there is very much also a fascistic quality about Trump in terms of this demagogic ethno-nationalist who wants to basically reinforce extreme notions of gender and race, you know, across society through violent means. He is in very you know, he's very much a classical fascist, and he is emboldening his supporters to go out and attack protesters. And, you know, like I said, with these car attacks, we've seen a lot of people. I had a piece in the Raw Story a couple of weeks ago where I actually documented Trump supporters themselves, including campaign workers, donors, and one alternate delegate have across the country have attacked Black Lives Matter protesters. There was one Trump 2016 campaign worker who killed a young African-American man in Omaha, Trump alternate delegate from New Mexico who shot a man in Albuquerque. So he is very much trying to stoke violence and create civil war. I think, though, if there's a silver lining to this, it shows how desperate he has become. And the other thing that does, you know, I think it's important that we keep things in perspective. You know, when he had the military assault demonstrators in Washington, D.C., and actually using counterinsurgency tactics like deploying the helicopters, the military ended up balking. Now, the leadership was willing to go along with it, but I think, you know, knowing people who are in the military, that there was a revolt among mid-level officers in the Pentagon, because you saw the military leadership then coming out a couple days later basically saying, we're not going to be allowed to have ourselves used against U.S. citizens demonstrating for their rights. So, you know, Trump is desperate, but the thing that kind of defines his reactions in 2020, there was a good article about this in Bloomberg News. Essentially what he does is he takes these high-risk not high risk, but low chance gambits. In other words, he basically does stuff like try and say, oh, the virus is going to go away, or the economy is going to recover, or we're going to have a vaccine later this year. And there's all very low chance of this happening. But if it does happen, then he benefits enormously.
Well, Arun, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article from The Intercept on our website. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist. He's written for The Washington Post, The Nation, Raw Story, The Guardian, Jacobin, and more. He's a regular news correspondent for our program, and his latest Intercept article, which we've been discussing, is entitled Seattle's Chop Went Out with Both a Bang and a Whimper. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.